December 19th, 2010. This is Jamel Bowie coming to you from Washington, D.C., and I'm with our wonderful contributors, Joel, who is a writer or reporter in Tampa, Florida.
What's up?
Nicole, who does food policy here in the district. And Monica, who is also a writer in D.C.
Hi.
We are going to be talking about three topics, as usual. The first is the Inez, can't actually pronounce her last name, so we're just going to say Inez. what would you call that? A scandal? A hubbub?
Yeah, I guess, yeah. A scandal, hubbub, controversy, if you will.
Inez controversy.
Right.
Go on to the D.C. mayoral race. The shocking D.C. mayoral race. It was exciting. And finally, we'll end with black people. Why don't they tip? I think Joel is going to grab the first topic. So let's start.
All right, cool. Well, I mean, at this point, this has been going on for nearly a week now. The interest in the case involving Inez. She's a reporter. It's with TV Azteca in Mexico. And she went to a practice at the New York Jets facility. It would have been Saturday. And we're not quite sure what happened from there. But what has been suggested has been there's been some degree of chicanery, you know, juvenile antics, cat calls, in short, harassment. Those allegations have been lobbed about from what happened that time. Now, for some context, you should do a Google search for Inez, and her first name is spelled I-N-E-S. Her last name is Sainz, I think, and it's S-A-I-N-Z. And you should do a Google search. She was a former swimsuit model. A lot of her notoriety comes from her being really, really, really attractive.
It's kind of bananas, actually.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, she's... You know, I mean, she's very noticeable. What's happened from this point on is that instead of having a discussion about harassment, what we've really had is a discussion on Inez and what she wore that day and what she's worn in the past and whether or not, strangely enough, women should be allowed into NFL locker rooms. And so obviously today I put up this post is for next week, but today, the day we're recording it, is Thursday, and I recently did a post on this talking a little bit about what's problematic about making the victim the one on trial, addressing the victim instead of addressing the people who are the alleged harassers. I've been arguing and talking these points over all week on Twitter, Facebook, arguing with my mom. You know, does anybody who will take this up with me? So I'll cede the floor now. I don't know. You know, I'm sure you guys have been following this yourselves, eh?
You know, I heard about it when it started to involve like the really ridiculous, response to the football player's actions, and that, you know, Inez was asking for it by being so attractive, which is just kind of like ridiculous, but in this instance, I think really ridiculous. The kinds of people saying it are extra ridiculous. Like, I expect conservatives and, you know, maybe football players to say, well, she was really attractive, so what were we supposed to do? But it's like sports commentators who previously hadn't seemed so dumb, now seeming really dumb.
Well, I mean, even somebody like Keith Olbermann, you know, who, you know, we'd like to think is relatively progressive, who, you know, made her one of, you know, included her as one of the worst people in the world. It's been disappointing. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say it said that essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, that this disgrace might be too strong of a word, but that, like, you know, she's not worthy of the legacy of some of the women, some of the pioneers in sports journalism, women who fought to get into these locker rooms and dealt with some of that earlier ugly harassment. Ugly, I mean, hard as it may be to believe, it may have been even uglier, some of the harassment that went on when women were first making inroads into sports journalism. And I mean, I think this is just, in short, I mean, obviously this is all stupid, right? I mean, you know.
I'm going to say something that is probably, I don't know. I'm just going to go ahead and throw it out there. So I have, there are two separate issues for me with this whole incident. The first one is that she should not have been harassed. End of story, bottom line, like, so it just, it stops right there. So there was no reason for the players. And I think a little more importantly, the coaches who were supposed to be role models of, to some degree, to do this. Like, it was just completely, totally, and entirely unacceptable.
Right.
I also, I don't, I know that her, the way that she is dressed has come into play in a lot of this. And I want to be very clear in saying that the way that she is dressed has nothing to do whatsoever with the harassment. Like, nothing. It doesn't matter what she had on. I think that you nailed it in your post, Joel, in saying that, especially talking about the running, a lot of times it has nothing to do with what you are or are not wearing. It's totally irrelevant. I don't think what she had on was professional. I think that that is a separate and completely different concern, however, from the harassment. I don't think that there's not a relationship between the two. There shouldn't be, and a large part of this problem is that people are conflating the two. And I'm going to leave it at that.
There has been a lot of talk about, you know, what she wore, you know, and people kind of separate those two issues too. But to me, that and also what she wears for the cameras and what she calls herself, which is like the hottest sports reporter on the planet, all are just more evidence of the sexism in sports journalism in general. Like, this is what this is what female journalists are expected to do. And it's also kind of true of female sports figures as well, right? Like, you have to kind of like trade on your sex in a way, because people expect you to, but it's this really fine line that you have to walk. And that kind of also has really nothing to do with that. That's everything to kind of put upon the women. It's not really like individual agency. But on Spanish language TV, I think those kinds of, that kind of dress is just kind of required and expected. So I think if Inez wanted to have a career in this, she doesn't have much of a choice. And I think that just speaks to sexism too.
Maybe it's my own sort of weird thing, but like when, and I understand and completely agree with what you're saying about the Spanish language TV. I mean, it is anyways, but it just, I have an issue with her calling herself a reporter and what I think of as a reporter. Because it seems like, and it's not just her dress. I mean, the questions that she's asking and the whole, like, let me measure your bicep, that whole thing. I take issue with that separately in sort of a professional context, completely and totally apart from the harassment issue.
Well, I think there's a couple things of that. One, and it's kind of ironic that we're saying this because I'm listening to you all, but there's also a college football game on right now, and the sideline reporter is a former swimsuit model. And this is ESPN. This isn't TV Azteca. Now, obviously, she's not wearing a bikini on screen. She's wearing a pantsuit. But, I mean, that kind of goes back to what Monica was saying about what, you know, TV stations and networks, the expectations they have for the women that get on air. But I think, you know, looking at what she wore that day, she wore jeans, which were, I mean, extremely tight, right? And she wore a white blouse. I don't find that unprofessional or the questions that she was asking. Because, I mean, reporting is a lot of things. You know, it's not just, well, you know, Mark Sanchez, break down the cover two defense for me. There's also, you know, the lighthearted side. And there's a lot of what a lot of what she does is like, it's not necessarily like hardcore sports reporting, but it's like pop culture stuff. And I think there's a place for that, too. And I think when we talk about professionalism, especially in this instance, it's her employers clearly don't have a problem with it. And the Jets didn't have a problem with it. You know, professional organizations, sports teams, whatever, they don't have to give you a press pass. You know, they don't have to give you access to their facility or to their players. They didn't – this conversation about professionalism and what somebody was wearing didn't come up until the accusations of harassment came up. And I know that, Nicole, you said that obviously these are two separate things, but I think it's really interesting how, like, all of a sudden we're talking about what people are wearing, and we can have that conversation, but I just find the timing odd, and it's not you, Nicole. I think it's
it's other people that are doing that. Because I've had this argument over and over again about all of a sudden these professional standards, and which kind of ironic too. Well, it's not ironic. We never talk about what men wear in the context of professionalism, right? Like, I guess it's kind of like whatever they're doing, it's professional because they showed up and they were men. And whether they had on shorts and a, you know, I'm the grits eating champion of 1997 t-shirt on, they're still.
I would take issue with that as well.
Yeah, I actually have a shirt like that, but I'll just wear it out for fun. But I wouldn't wear it to work. But I mean, there are people that wear stuff like that. I mean, like, you know, sports journalists have a reputation for being schlubby for a reason. You know, it's not, you know, it's they earn some of that reputation. And I've been in a lot of press boxes and a lot of locker rooms. And so it always comes back to women, their dress, like, well, she's wearing is not professional. Aaron Andrews on ESPN had to deal with that. Hannah Storm on ESPN had to deal with that. It's a conversation that we always have about women, but we never seem to have it about men.
I would also just say one other thing really kind of quickly, and that's that, remember there was a few months ago a woman who sued Citibank because she said she was fired for being too attractive. Her name was Deborah Lee Lorenzana. There was a study about that time or released just after that found that very attractive women are discriminated against in fields that we see as traditionally masculine. And one of the things is as women who kind of are traditionally attractive or whatever are always seen to kind of dress unprofessionally. So it's like, you know, it's kind of tough because it's like there really isn't a such thing as like professional dress. If like a woman is wearing a suit and she's just really safe, shapely and has larger breasts, the men in the office are always going to say that that is an unprofessional outfit. Do you know what I mean? So I just think it's like just extra dangerous too when we talk about, you know, professionalism and women's clothing in these kinds of fields. It usually is a signal for that. And so it's like, you know, yeah, Joel's right. Yeah. No, we never talk about this until there's this kind of sexual harassment, something comes up.
Right.
Well, I am more than willing to have a podcast about some of the poor, poor fashion choices that I have seen on male sportscasters. I'm all for it.
Yeah, right. I mean, well, yeah. Craig Sager on TNT, who, I mean, just looks like, you know, he's going to a player's ball, you know, circa 1997. He looks like Pimpin' Ken, you know, every... Like at every basketball game. And it's funny, you know, oh, Craig, you know, what is he going to wear that's wacky today? You know, nobody ever says it's unprofessional. But like,
what's that guy? I could go to the job.
Oh, Ron Cherry, the hockey guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he looks insane. He looks like he's wearing, you know, curtains. He's wearing, you know, couch design on him every day. His outfit comes with everything but karate slippers, essentially. You know what I'm saying? And like, nobody ever says, like, well, Ron Cherry, that's crazy. You know, they just say, oh, that's funny, but there's never a conversation about whether or not it's professional. And I find that sort of problematic. And, I was telling somebody the other day, I mean, kind of moving forward here, that, like, I'm not going to say that I was skeptical of the phrase rape culture, but, like, I didn't like, you know, using it because I felt like it was an atomic bomb in a conversation because then people, like, really get worked up and it's hard to like get people to listen then. And so I was like, I don't know if rape culture is the phrase that I'm comfortable with, but I think like this particular situation has really made me see the importance of like talking about what rape culture is and like the problems with it, because a lot of the conversation, a lot of the excuses that people are making defending harassers, men, you know, well, it's you know, these guys, they're meatheads. They can't control themselves around, you know, sexy women. Like, what the fuck? Are you serious? Like, that's a real argument.
True. I don't know if you've ever walked the streets of a major city, Joel, but if you have, then you'll see that when sexy women walk by, all the men immediately reached into their pants.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like, can I borrow your lotion, please? I don't know, man. I've talked about this briefly in the comments. Like, there's some serious racial overtones to this too, because we can't deny that the NFL is like 65% black. In terms of players, and like we're having all these arguments about how these men can't control themselves and it's a cave in there and these guys, they're meatheads and whatever, and I'm just like, are we really ignoring, like, you know, the, you know, all these like insinuations about the myth of the, like, the, you know, the untamed black sexual savage? Like, are we really like do you realize where we're going when we make those sorts of arguments? I find it really problematic, and I've really like lost a lot of respect for people this week having these debates with them, because I can't understand how like anybody can say, well, harassment is wrong, but like that's not, you know, it's like rape is unacceptable, except like there's no, you know, there is no but, there is no except here.
I think it comes from an inability to sort of like just see outside oneself, right? Like if it were the case that men had to worry about being harassed on a regular basis, and if like a man was harassed and like the first thing people said was, you know, he shouldn't have been wearing those pants without any pleats because you can clearly see, you know, it's junk. Like, what were you expecting to happen? Like, it's funny because it's so absurd, but that's actually sort of like the point. Like, if men lived in that kind of world, then they'd be a lot more sensitive to, you know, harassment, to concerns of harassment. But that they don't means that they can sort of pretend like it isn't as ubiquitous as it actually is.
Look, I just want to qualify that and say, like, the majority of straight men, I think a lot of gay men get a lot of street harassment, or men perceived as being gay.
Yeah.
It also is, like, confusing to me that people can't separate the idea of, like, finding someone attractive and also harassing them. It's like, well, I found her attractive, so I guess I got to say something to her that might be over the line. I can't just, like, sit here and think, boy, that's an attractive person, and go about my day.
Right. Right. Right.
There's no real way to make a segue from that. It's like, oh, attractive people, harassment. And now DC mayoral race. So,
Fenty Street Team showed up at my house at least 4 times in the last week. I think that qualifies as harassment.
There we go. Yeah, I got harassed about my, you know, whether I was registered to vote a lot.
Monica, if you could kind of give us a quick intro to the DC mayoral race, that would be great.
Yeah, sure thing. So I am a new resident to D.C., but the D.C. mayor, Adrian Fenty, had gotten a lot of national attention before because he was kind of part of this, you know, trifecta of kind of really popular politicians like Barack Obama and Cory Booker, who was going to, like, change the world. You know, he was like a new thinking politician. And so he came in as a, you know, guns a-blazing as a reformer, and he served one term, and Deval Patrick as well in Massachusetts. So there's just like this really a lot of a national attention to these guys. And Adrian Fenty was really responsible for trying to shape up the city government here, and he fired a lot of people. Part of Fenty's reforms, too, was hiring Michelle Rhee, who it was a Teach for America alum, who had also started a nonprofit in New York that trained career changers to be teachers in inner cities. And she came in and started evaluating teachers and also other school employees on a new system, and fired them and, you know, kind of started calling schools ineffective and really was really, really tough. And she probably did some of these things in maybe an impolitic way. And so this mayoral election was seen as kind of a referendum on school reform. Fenty's challenger, Vincent Gray, who is the chair of the city council, hadn't committed to keeping Rhee on. And so there's some, you know, thought that he'll probably fire Rhee. And Fenty, you know, of course, was still committed to Rhee and the whole school reform issue. Now, polls show that actually parents with children actually supported school reform. But there's kind of the bigger issue, too, and that's just that Fenty fired a lot of people. He was kind of seen as arrogant and elitist and kind of responsible for changing demographics in D.C. So Courtland Malloy at the Washington Post wrote a column about the primary, which this is a Democratic primary, by the way, and whoever won the Democratic primary was pretty much almost certain to win the general election in November. So he really called this a populist revolt. So I'll throw it to Nicole, who probably knows more about DC politics because she's been here longer, but do you think it was a populist revolt?
I don't know that it was a populist revolt. I do want to add, though, that I think it's important to note the last election. So Fenty won every single precinct in Washington, D.C. in the last election, which is as overwhelming a mandate as you could possibly have. And this time around, and this is why the Courtland Malloy sort of hit piece really, really bothers me, is that there were there's a huge demographic split in the way that people voted, and this election was pretty divisive. Like, people were really getting into it. There were all of these sort of crazy, especially towards the end, crazy accusations being thrown around about, you know, poll, especially about like voting stuff not working or people harassing other, you know, election workers or volunteers for one campaign or another. And it was just, it was really divisive. And that Malloy hit piece does nothing to sort of figure out, okay, well, now what do we go from here? Like, this whole Reid thing is a really, 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 really big part of DC's future.
I think the Malloy piece was really divisive and annoying, but I think it actually gets to like sort of the core issues in the election. Adam Sower at the American Prospect wrote a really great post. Disclosure, I'm sure all you know this, but Adam is a colleague of myself and Monica. But he wrote a really great post, kind of, well, first he had tweeted a while back that the Gray candidacy was something of a DC Tea Party, and other people elaborated on that, but Adam wrote a really great post sort of like outlining what he meant, which was mainly that there are these really significant demographic changes going on in DC. By 2015, it's estimated DC will no longer be a majority African-American city, which is a really big deal. Like, it's been a majority African-American city for a very, very long time. You know, people may not have liked the fact that their local corner was unsafe, but at least they could afford to live there. And that's changing. I mean, I myself am something of a black gentrifier. Like, I've moved into a neighborhood in DC, which only a few years ago was too rough for a lot of people to go through, and it is now a pretty nice place. I think the complaints about the teacher firings are actually really interesting because, you know, it seems that there's like a different conception of what public service in DC ought to be. Ryan Event and Matt Iglesias both made this point, but it's mostly that, you know, the way Malloy wrote it, the teacher firings are sort of like a slap in the face because you're firing all of these African-American, middle-class, mostly women who rely on public jobs to get by, to like make their lives, livelihoods in the city. And that's a really stark contrast to, I think, how Fenty and sort of the pro-Fenty community views city government, which is as, you know, it's responsive to the people who are consuming the services, right? Like, it's not that the garbage collection agency doesn't exist to provide working class men with jobs. It exists to pick up people's trash. And if it doesn't do that well, you should just do something to change it. And likewise, the school system doesn't exist to give, you know, middle class African American women jobs. It exists to teach kids. And I think what's happened is that Fenty never really tried to communicate that difference of how the city services should operate. It really like created a huge backlash.
Yeah, I also think that's part of what people like me who are new to the city kind of didn't get about the race. And so that's why it was interesting to me. My entire block voted for Gray, and it was just for that reason. And they also just thought Fenty was really kind of corrupt, that he just, you know, gave contracts to all of his friends, and his friends like didn't necessarily do a better job than anybody else would have. So it was, he was just kind of a lord over the manor kind of thing. Yeah. And so that's just the general impression that they had of him. But I think it's also a lesson for people who really kind of care about school reform, and that's that, like, you know, that the things that the community thinks you're doing are really, really important. And so, you know, Michelle Rhee is a really divisive figure for good reason. I mean, she's really not very easy with her rhetoric. And so I think that, you know, even if it wasn't necessarily just schools that people were upset about, she's a really good symbol for what was happening, because she just came in with this idea that, like, the concerns of technocrats are more important than all else.
Actually, one of my best friends worked in the Fenty administration up until, I guess it would have been about a year ago, and then he moved away. And one of the things that he talked about a lot, and I mean, dealing with Michelle Rhee, he didn't talk so much about that, but just in general about the arrogance of Mayor Fenty. He talked a lot about he didn't empower the people on his staff, that he didn't listen to them. And I think it kind of feeds into the piece that ran in the Washington Post, which was the day that after the election, the kind of breaking down, you know, what happened to Adrian Finpey. Like, he just ignored a lot of his advisors. You know, they wanted him to apologize for the kind of his heavy-handed, aloof manner. And he refused, and he just said, you know, I'll go with my gut. You know, this is what got me here, and that's what's going to keep me here. And you can kind of see, I could, reading that piece, like, a lot of the things that my friend said about him was kind of reflected in that. And, you know, again, with schools, it's like what he was saying is that, you know, the people in D.C., and this is obviously a generalization, but he said, you know, they just want to be heard. They want to know that you care. And, you know, that people had tried to work on Adrian Finty with, like, you know, being a little bit more personable, but it never really came to pass.
It also sort of trickled down a little bit into some of the national media, I guess, and a lot of the people who write for the national media who happen to be located here in D.C. have focused a lot on this mayoral race, but there were also a lot of like the city council and the ANC, which are the advisory neighborhood commissions, like your little block, like those elections were also, primary elections were also happening at the same time. And you sort of saw the same dynamic breaking down, particularly in the ward where I think I live, Monica and Jamel. I don't know if you guys are also in Ward 1, but which contains like some of the most rapidly gentrifying parts of the city, like Columbia Heights, U Street. There was that dynamic with the city, with the Ward 1, the Ward 1 race between Jim Graham, who is sort of like the old guard, who there are a lot of people who feel like isn't listening, and that he's been sort of responsible for a lot of the gentrification. And then there was another guy named Brian Weaver who was running on, actually kind of took a page, I think, from Finty's playbook, like going door to door and saying, this is who I am, this is what I'll do for you. Like, I think there was someone outside of one of the polling places saying, it's not about power, it's about people's lives, vote for Weaver. And the same dynamic happened over on Capitol Hill in Ward 6, where the guy there, Tommy Wells, is basically running on a platform of making it a livable, walkable, like very urbanist community. And the guy, I forget his name, who was running against him, tried to play the race card and saying, you know, you only care about, like, those are things that only matter to people that are just moving here. You know, we care about crime and we care about, you know, things like that, which is a little bit ridiculous because at the end of the day, and this is something that a lot of people have made in with the Finty Ree Gray thing, at the end of the day, good schools benefit everyone. At the end of the day, having a safe, walkable neighborhood benefits everyone, regardless of how long you've lived here.
I don't know how many people saw the HBO documentary about Mary and Barry. It came out last year, and I want to say it's like The Nine Lives of Mary and Barry. And it was really, really interesting. I mean, first of all, if you can't watch it and finish that and not feel sorry for him. But I think the way that they talk a little bit about how he came to power and how he gained prominence and, you know, a lot of loyalty within the city is that he had a jobs program that was hiring a lot of people that were, like, yep, not able to get jobs. Yep. And that sort of stuff matters, you know, to a certain subset of the population. I mean, people say, well, you know, this dude helped me get a job, or, you know, at least he, you know, whether or not, you know, I think some people think that there are things that are beyond their control, like crime and like the schools. Like, it seems complicated and it seems hard, and you're not quite sure that any one person can do anything about it. But if you know somebody, if you think somebody cares, and they gave your uncle who just got out of, you know, prison a jail, I mean, get a job, that might matter, you know. And if you seem really aloof and you don't care, that does take its toll. And I think that's, you know, since we're talking about this new guard of, like, quote, post-racial candidates, a phrase I hate, but you think back to somebody like Cory Booker, who Adrian Finney was compared to a lot, and he spends a lot of time, you know, trying to show that his constituents and his residents that he cares, because I think, you know, there's a lot of things that are similar between New York and D.C. in terms of, like, you know, the constituent base there.
I mean, just to respond to that, I think, I mean, the problem with the Barry method of gaining popularity, though, is that it turns city services into, like, it turns it into a jobs program. That's not what city services are. I mean, I think, like, policy-wise, I think Fenty made the right decision, right? Like, to, in kind of carrying over from the previous administration, making city services respond more to the people who are using them, which is all DCers, right? That's everyone living in the district, all Washingtonians, but moving away from this idea of a city job as being an entitlement, right? Like, that just it's not, you're being given a city job because you're qualified to have a city job, not because you need to, you discontinue the job. But I definitely understand why people got really upset when he fired a bunch of people. Like, I'm sure even if he had made the case to Washingtonians that, listen, I'm going to have to make firings because there are just too many city employees, we need to streamline things, they'd still be upset because D.C. has double-digit unemployment. And if, you know, having a bunch of people fired, especially people, middle and working class African Americans who will have a statistically harder time finding a new job than their white counterparts, it kind of throws them out into this very harsh economy, and that creates lots of resentment. And that resentment, you know, it's totally justified, and I understand why those people voted against Fenty. One of the things that's kind of annoyed me about elite discussion of the D.C. election is that there seems to be this sense that, like, it's, you know, it's fine that Tea Partiers vote, you know, rave against Obama and vote for crazies because they're full of resentment, but it's weird for black people to do it, too. Insofar that Fenty failed is because, you know, he didn't realize that part of his job was attending to those. Not to, like, monologue too much, but, like, last week, Matt Iglesias wrote this really, really silly post where he was like, I don't understand why we just can't shop mayors around the different cities, because if a mayor can fix one city, you know, reason holds that he could probably do the same for another. But part of a mayor's job isn't just being a boring technocrat. Part of a mayor's job is being in tune with this community and understanding the local politics of the area, understanding the dynamics. And the best mayors leverage those dynamics to get their policy goals both accomplished and sort of lasting, like, so that the any few successors are working within their paradigm. And I don't think Fenty understood that point at all. Like, he didn't get...
Insane, because that's the way he got elected last time. Like, the man literally went door to door to say, hi, I'm Adrian Fenty, I'm running for mayor, and I want to hear what you think I should do and what your problems are. Like, the whole gimmick was that he wore out, like, two or three pairs of shoes or something like that, literally pounding the pavement every day talking to people. And it's a little insane, and I'll leave my personal voting preferences out of it, but it's just crazy to me that to go from that to losing the election because you're not listening to people. Like, I don't know what the disconnect was. I don't know what happened, but it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the best politicians are the ones that continue. I mean, not best, maybe popular is the better word, because you think about somebody like Marion Barry, who's popularity endures. Or you think about somebody like Sharp James, whose popularity endures. Or there, you know, and I worked in Louisiana. There was a guy who went to federal prison for taking a bribe, and it has been reelected 3 or 4 times to his same council seat. And you know, but the thing is, he's a guy. He rolls around in a Jeep, waves at people. You know, oh, hey, how you doing? You know, and that sort of stuff matters. And if you think you're beyond that, then, like, the voters will show you that's not true.
It's not right. I mean, it's not just, like, good politicians can do that well, but I think the best people who govern, like, I was going to say governors, but that's sort of generic term for anyone who governs a city or whatever, are people who can leverage that to make policy.
Right.
Which is what Cory Booker does, right? That's, like, the big difference, because Marion Barry, in addition to doing all these things that we think of as bad governing, you know, rolled around the city and talked to people. And if he heard a poll was heard a poll was closing early and kids wouldn't have a place to hang out in the summer, he would go to that poll and do whatever he could to get it open. But, I mean, Cory Booker kind of combines the Fenty technocratic method with actually being on the street almost every day.
Yeah. I've been trying to fit a Wire reference into this, but I can't. Okay, so with all this talk about black folk and their rational or irrational things they may or may not do, Nicole wrote a piece about tipping on Post Bougie, and whether or not, you know, black people are good tippers. So if you want to give us an idea of what you think.
All right, so it wasn't necessarily just whether or not black people are good tippers. Someone, I'm not going to name any names.
Yeah, don't do that. Right.
brought up an element of poor shaming, basically, in the whole tipping practice, and said that you shouldn't shame people if they can't tip when they go to a restaurant. Okay, so the whole tipping thing started with a really, really bad, poorly written, and even more poorly reasoned post about Black people not being good tippers and the reasons why they don't tip, which is some sort of awful armchair psychoanalysis that I don't want to get into, but it's miserable, and we link to it if you want to read it. And someone called out the post, which I totally agree with. It was just complete BS. But also added that there was an element of poor shaming and not tipping, and that you shouldn't necessarily say, you know, if you can't afford to tip, then you shouldn't go out to eat or you should stay home. No, I personally believe that that is ludicrous. I think that for me, tipping is such an integral part of the dining out experience, regardless of whether you're at like your truck stop diner or like the super nice wine bar that opened down the street or at TGI Fridays. Like, you always tip. It's just that it's part of eating out. And part of this comes from, I waited tables through college and after college. And for me, not tipping someone if they've given you acceptable or better than acceptable service is basically saying, I don't have any, I don't place any value on what you're doing, and I expect you to, because I don't want to pay you. I think that it's completely ridiculous, and I take serious issue with it. I actually wrote in the post, for me, it's a lot like going to the store, buying a pair of shoes, getting to the register and saying, well, I have enough for the shoes, but I don't have enough for the tax on them. That means that you can't afford the shoes. Like, integral to me.
Okay, well, I mean, there's a difference between taxing and like a gratuity, which, I mean, literally means like extra, like it's not required. But anyway, okay, since I'm going to take up for this really smart guy who you're attacking right now.
I'm not attacking the guy. I am attacking what
he said. No, I know. I'm just joking. This is how I came up, because I really have a problem with people saying you shouldn't do this because you're poor. Look, first of all, I'm trying to be really circumspect about this, but let me just start off with the part about poor people shouldn't go out because if they can't afford tip. You know, the bill and the cost of the food is what it is, right? Like, that's what you are required to pay. When somebody goes to a restaurant, they don't go for service. They go for food. And how you get the food to me is immaterial. I would argue if you're like going to something and you get the food or whatever, I think a lot of times people just go for food. They don't think a lot about like the service. Like, I never really spent a lot of time thinking about tipping until I got old enough to pay for my own food. I was like, we go to a restaurant to eat. I don't care. You know, my mom brings me food at home. I don't tip her. So, you know, it doesn't click until you get older. And let me just, you know, give the clarification here. I tipped extremely well. Like, I try to tip 20% of it because I understand it's a tough job. I think it wasn't until much later that I understood that, like, servers, busboys, is accountable for paying their staff a minimum wage or a livable wage. But it's easier to say, well, you're broke, you know, you can afford the food, but you can't afford the service, so you shouldn't come here. I don't think it should be like that. That's the element of poor shaming to me. Because I think, there's places in this country, like in Miami, for instance, where the gratuity is added into the cost of the eating out experience. And if you can't afford that, then I agree with you that you shouldn't go out.
I don't understand how that's any different.
Yeah. I think part of the problem is that I'm sure at some like point in the past that I don't remember or don't know of, tipping literally was a gratuity. Like, it was just, you know, if you feel that your service was exceptional, please add this no money, but otherwise we're cool. But we've gotten to a point where it's basically like a semi-mandatory thing. It's things a restaurant owner counts on to make up for the fact that they are legally allowed to charge below minimum wage. I'm really sympathetic to Nicole for the simple reason that, with that in mind, because culturally tipping is basically mandatory, then, you know, at the very least, like, if you go out to dinner, you should factor the, it's not that you shouldn't go out to dinner, but you should, you know, if you go to dinner, you should maybe think of getting a less expensive entree, if you know that you can't afford to both get your meal and tip. Like, it shouldn't even really be called a gratuity anymore, because it isn't.
I think Jamel was right. I think it's a change over time, but I also think it's a change from place to place in the country. I think, you know, because I spent a lot of time going to the middle part of the country, and it's really not expected that you would tip anything like 20%. And actually, like, a tip still is a gratuity that you give for good service. And for a lot of different places, a tip is like the change that you just don't take from your bill. Mm-hmm. So I think that especially in cities like DC or New York, where you get a lot of tourists, you really kind of don't think it's ridiculous to give someone a 20% tip. You know, so there are people who wouldn't tip that well, and there are also people who wouldn't tip if they wouldn't if they don't perceive it as I do it because I feel like I should. But what we should really talk about is people paying people a livable wage.
Okay. I would draw the distinction between not tipping and, or build on the distinction you made between not tipping well and not tipping. Like, I usually tip 20 to 25%. It's because I used to be a waitress. Like, that's just my baseline. I understand that not everyone is going to tip like that. And I am actually more okay with you tipping poorly than I am with people just not tipping at all. And, but I wanted to make that point. And then I also wanted to make the point, it feels almost insulting to me, and I think that's part of the reason why I take issue with it, is because, like you said, you are paying for that convenience. You're paying for me or for someone to bring the food to you, you know, to bring you extra napkins, to do whatever. If you didn't want to do that, then you shouldn't be, you know, there are other places where you can go to get food where you don't have to deal with all of that. And those are the places where you also don't, generally speaking, have to tip people.
You said the convenience, and I think, you know, we really assume a lot about what people know or understand about restaurants, because, again, I mean, certainly, I wasn't poor or anything. I grew up in a relatively middle-class family. But, like, all these things that we're talking about, like, you know, the minimum wage, you know, not getting the minimum wage, and I think, you know, servers are even taxed on what the government expects to be like a 15% tip, right? Is that how it works?
Yes.
Am I making that up? Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that until like a couple years ago, and I'm 32, right? So like, there's a lot of things that I think people understand about like the restaurant industry, but they don't. And I mean, you talk about the convenience, about you're paying for the service and people bringing you food and the preparation of the food. I think a lot of people like me at one point thought that cost was built into what you bought. Like, I mean, you wouldn't go anywhere and pay $10 for a burger normally, right? But you say, well, I pay $10 at a restaurant because it's, you know, all these things, whatever it takes to get the burger here to my table, that's built in there. And I think, again, I'm not advocating people not tip at all, because like, I tip, I think you should tip. When I would go out with my mother and she'd try to, you know, bring out her little, you know, tip thing, or like she'd break out her calculator, I'm like, look, seriously, like 20% is like really easy. Let's just do that, right? So like, again, I'm not advocating, you know, people not tip. I'm advocating for understanding for people who don't know a lot of these things that go on in restaurants and the costs that are associated with getting your food out to you.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I agree with you. I had to explain tipping to my mom. But we always thought the fanciest place we had ever been in my whole entire life was like Ruby Tuesday. And they just thought I'm dead serious. And they just thought that that's why you were paying $10 for a salad, is because that was all included in the bill. And so, yeah, no, I think it's not people being purposefully hurtful. I think it's just kind of and not understanding totally thing.
All right, well, I'm going to conduct an education campaign so that everyone knows so that we don't ever have to talk about it again.
Also, in addition to that education campaign, I think that people should really push restaurants to pay their staffers a minimum wage or something equivalent to that. Also,
or give them really sick important. Days. There's been a huge movement for that. They got torpedoed in D.C. because when you work in a restaurant, you don't get any sick days. You don't get any kind of leave. You're just SOL.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Instead of shaming consumers, I think like we really should do a better job of holding employers accountable for the things that go on. And like I said, when I've been to restaurants as I've gotten older that have the gratuity already included, and I've never had a problem with that. Like, I'm totally understanding of that. I think that's great. And I think that that should be more the rule rather than the exception. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
I agree. In the meantime, though, you should tip.
Yeah, right.
I also think there's some confusion about tipping, because I feel like everywhere you go, you see a tip jar now. And like, the people slinging coffee at Starbucks get health care and at least a minimum wage, you know? So yeah. I'm glad that they have their tip jar out, but it's not like you're taking money out of their pocket if you don't tip them.
Yeah. Can we also just talk about this, I mean, this myth that black people don't tip? If tipping is a class thing, then this is almost certainly an extension. If black people don't tip, it's probably more because, A, there are more black people who are working class, disproportionately, and B, there's a larger proportion of middle class, upper middle class black people who came from working class or poor backgrounds than, you know, white folks, right? So, like, you might have a, you know, newly up and coming, you know, like a little Jefferson moving up and going to a restaurant and not really realizing the culture, not really understanding the culture of tipping because where they came from class wise, that wasn't really an issue.
Right. I could, right. And I did this in the post, like, I feel like you could make all kinds of generalizations about the sort of people that do tip, that do not tip, and I don't just mean based on race. You could do it based on the time of day, on their gender, like, whatever. And they're so specific to that particular restaurant in that particular neighborhood on that particular day that I think it's pretty worthless.
If you can stereotype about anyone tipping, I would actually be really curious to know how hipsters tip.
Because in my experience, poorly.
Tipping feeling. Yeah, that's what I thought. That hipsters tip, which actually might be a good way to segue into, you know, shout outs, because I haven't shouted down hipsters ever, and it's something I probably should do sometime. So
I think instead we should just ask Nicole about every kind of demographic group we can.
Oh, I've got generalizations for days, don't you worry.
Oh, what about women with kids and strollers?
We had a strict no babies in the bar rule, and we would give you the stink eye if you came in with your child.
Good. Okay.
Good.
That's what I want to hear. All right, now we can do shout outs. I'm happy.
Okay, shout outs. Who would start? Joel, shout out?
Yeah, shout out. Well, I know I listened last week and Chani said that I get, you know, I make like 14 shout outs. So I'm going to make two. One, because I didn't get a chance to do it last week, is for thank God for football season.
Woo-hoo!
Yes. Like, I know, you know, my wife is like a football widow for like the next 4 months, but like our Saturdays are like, we don't do anything during the middle of the day because football's on, and my college is a number 4 in the country in football, so I'm very excited about that. And just on some random stuff, this is shout outs, right? I can do whatever. I've been listening to a lot of Stevie Wonder for like the last week, and all the songs that I really like seem to have to do with like space travel. Like, we were talking about this with Isabel the other day, like Rocket, you know, Rocket Man, heaven is, you know, 10 zillion light years away, all these things. And so I'm just really like in a Stevie Wonder mode. I don't know if that's because it's becoming fall or whatever, but that's my shout out, Stevie and football. That's all the things I love in life, but in my family. And so
Nicole.
All right, so I am going to co-sign on to Joel's shout-out about football season, although I am more of an NFL fan. So my Sundays pretty much stop at about 12:45. I set my fantasy light up, and then that's it. I'm done for the rest of the day. And I am so thankful that that is back because I feel like my life has a purpose again. I am also going to make, when I'm not ranting about tipping, I'm also going to make a super dorky shout out to the humble mason jar because it is tomato canning season at my house. And Monica canned tomatoes last week. My roommate did some this past weekend. And with any luck, I will be canning tomatoes. And let me tell you, there is nothing like busting into some home can, like middle of summer tomatoes in the middle of February when it's snowy and you feel like you're going to die and never leave the house again. It will make your life in a way that I can't even express to you. So shout out for tomatoes in the humble mason jar.
I'm going to shout out two things. The first is that one of my favorite bands, LCD Sound System, is playing at the Charlottesville Pavilion, and the tickets for only like $30. So I'm going, it's going to be awesome. I'll probably be the only black person there, but that's okay. and the second, speaking of being the only black person in places, the second shout out goes to the 2010 Values Voters Summit, which is tomorrow from the day we're recording. So today is, you know, So this will have been the previous Friday. I will be hobnobbing with lots of social conservatives, and I might even get an interview with some, you know, Tea Partiers or something. I don't know. It's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it, like, in an honest, sincere way. I think it's going to be really interesting. So, yeah.
Wow.
Those are my two shout-outs.
That's how you want to spend your weekend, huh?
Monica?
I have a shout-out. So I was really sick last week. There's this awful flu going around DC, and I got it. And I watched The Karate Kid, all three movies on Netflix Watch Instantly. And I sort of forgot how fabulous that movie is. It's, first of all, now that I'm an adult, I recognize it's really, really racist. There's, you know, basically an Asian man who has healing powers and teaches this young white kid about life. But otherwise, it's really fantastic, and I love it. And I forgot that I actually probably knew the whole movie by heart, and I was, like, saying the lines as they were happening. And it also has one of the best 80s movies songs of all time during the tournament of the first one. But
the montage song. You're the best.
No, that's the tournament song.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a montage of him at the tournament.
Okay. Yeah, I love that movie because that's two of my favorite lines from any movie ever, which are, put him in the body bag!
Oh, Cobra Kai.
Sometimes I'll be like watching a sporting event, you know, with some people, and I'll yell, like, put him in a body bag, and people are like, why are you so horrible?
It's because you're too young. Everybody older than you totally knows that line. The other thing it did is opened up this great new Netflix category, feel good family dramas from the 1980s. So that actually, because
very specific.
They all are very, very specific. And this opened up, but before that, I was somewhat limited to dark comedies with a strong female lead, romantic comedies with a strong female lead, period movies with a strong female lead. So you kind of see the pattern I was like stuck in before. So this like got me out of my movie watching rut, and it opened up all these feel good movies from the 1980s. And so
you unlocked the next level of Netflix.
I think we're done here. So thank you all for listening, and on behalf of Joel, Nicole, and Monica, see you in 2 weeks or so, perhaps, maybe. I want to end that like really threateningly. Like, maybe you'll see us in 2 weeks.
Our theme music is 8 by Aeon. You can catch us at postbougie.com.
He has to say done. He has to say done. That's what we always
done. Say. Done. Done. I fuck it. I really just want to carve out a space for myself with Post Bougie as like the abrasive jerk of the group. Which is funny because it's like the complete opposite of me.
I know. Yeah, that's why it's so awesome. That's why we always have a running joke that we want Jamel to start doing like a monocast for the American Prospect called Things That Make Jamel Angry. And he just like in his complete monotone describes the things that made him angry that week. Things that made me angry this week. First of all, I was very angry by this inaccurate post.
Then someone gave me a sandwich with mayonnaise, and I was really pissed off about that, too.
This is the most powerful nation on Earth. Can't we figure out a way to refrigerate Malamars properly? Bottom line, America, I should be able to eat Malamar cookies anytime I want, even in the summer.